I brought a reading with me today, and I'll just preface my remarks by saying that, you know, I've been a member of Westminster for 24 years, and for 22 of those years, it never occurred to me that I might have a sermon in me that I would want to offer to the congregation. We had had many lay services. Some of our best services ever at Westminster have been lay services, and I'm sure that's probably the case here as well, not to diminish Betty's work with you. But I just never felt that I had one in me. And it wasn't until my wife died, and in having many conversations with Barbara Fast afterwards, that it began to kind of slowly emerge that maybe I did have something to say. And so I bring that up because perhaps somewhere out there, there's somebody that has one sermon in them. And if you do, I would encourage you to talk to Betty about it and share it with the congregation. This reading comes from a book titled Healing into Life and Death, which is where the name from the sermon came from, by a gentleman named Stephen Levine, who's, I believe, a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist. And this was given to me shortly before Jean passed away. It's called Qualities of Healing. This process of going beyond our suffering is a bit like the story of the eight Hasidic scholars translating an ancient Hebraic text when they came across the line, "Suffering is grace." They stopped short, sharing with each other in great candor that although they had heard this text many times, they didn't really comprehend it. How can suffering really be grace? Each, feeling uncomfortable with any casual translation of such a remarkable concept, felt that they could go no further without some deeper understanding. How can it be so? They asked each other. Then one of the rabbis suggested, "Wait, just outside of town lives crippled Jonathan. Jonathan has known great travail and many illnesses in his life. His son was killed by the great floods that ruined his land and covered his home with mud. But as he was burying his son and cleaning up the soil that ruined his house, he began to sing to God. Some years later, his wife became quite ill because he could hardly grow enough food to support them. But that did not stop his song. Later, when he broke his leg and couldn't afford a physician so that it never healed quite properly and left him with a rather painful limp, Jonathan seemed still unruffled. Jonathan, even in those sparse fields, even during drought, constantly spoke and sang to God. If anyone knows how suffering may be grace, Jonathan would be the person to ask. He is so poor and has had such misfortune, yet he seems to be at peace." So the eight rabbis set out to the impoverished farm of Jonathan and his wife. Meeting them at the porch, they were invited to share in the meager supper. Of course, the rabbis demurred, noting that he had so little and was so generous to share, which brought them to the reason for their visit. They told Jonathan of their difficulty in honestly translating, "Suffering is grace." They felt that he, of all the people they knew, might be able to elucidate its meaning, because somehow all his misfortune seemed not to have diminished his heartfulness. "How, Jonathan, with the loss of your child and farm, and you and your wife's poor health, can you still sing to God? How have you found that suffering can be grace?" To which Jonathan sheepishly replied, "I'm very sorry you made this long trip and that I cannot help you. You've come to the wrong man to ask this question. I am not suffering." Healing into life and death. I never knew my grandmother, Golda Tisser, but I've spent a great deal of time thinking about her and her life. My father, Max, was born in 1922 and grew up in a comfortable household in Vienna, Austria, well before World War II. He and his mother, Golda, his father, Leo, and his twin brother, Sam, lived fairly comfortably in an oversized apartment at number 9 Schlüsselgasse, not far from the very famous Votive Church in Vienna. 2 days after I graduated college, my friend Eddie and I embarked on a 3-week tour of Europe. My singular mission, was to see where my dad had grown up. Having a Viennese father seemed very exotic to me. What I didn't know was that I would meet my future wife, Jean, the very first day that Eddie and I arrived in Zurich. But I digress. After the annexation of Austria by Germany in March of 1938 and the pogroms of Kristallnacht in August of 1938, Jewish families in Vienna had very difficult decisions to make. Sam and my father were sent to London in 1939 to stay with their uncle Harry. They were 17 years old. A short time later, their father Leo joined them. Golda stayed behind in Vienna, tying up loose ends for the family and caring for her widowed mother, Henny. She intended to join them eventually, or maybe the plan was for the others to return to Vienna after the war. Like many others, she misjudged the window of opportunity to leave and never succeeded in doing so. She was trapped for 3 years along with her mother, Henny, who had no intention of ever leaving. On May 20th, 1942, she was deported from Vienna by the Nazis. And almost 700 miles later, she arrived at the Mali-Trostenok death camp, just outside of Minsk in present-day Belarus. The camp had begun operations just 2 weeks earlier. The war was not going well for the Nazis, and they were redoubling their efforts to carry out their plan to exterminate the Jews. Using information obtained from those who were there, it is known with reasonable certainty that her group of deportees were transferred from their crammed railroad car to trucks that took them a short distance to the Sharets Nova forest, where they were unloaded next to large pits, told to strip, and then shot in the head. She was 50 years old. Her mother, Henny, my great-grandmother, was deported a month later and sent to an internment camp in what is now the Czech Republic. 3 months later, on September 19th, 1942, she was transferred to the Treblinka death camp in Poland, where she too was exterminated. She was 74 years old. As you can see, no matter how many years have passed, the sheer horror of what they went through remains incomprehensible. Yet a small part of me wonders, maybe hopes is a better word, whether they were able to find peace within themselves as the end came near, whether they were able to heal themselves into their deaths. Is it even possible under such circumstances? Understandably, my father never spoke of it. The years of waiting and not knowing must have been crushing. How does one heal back into life after such an experience? Yet he and millions of others of his generation did just that, at least to the best of their abilities. The man I remember was gentle and upbeat, with a wonderful sense of humor, and an easygoing sense of life. He spent his career helping others and serving his community through local politics. He never missed an election and was a town meeting member for many, many years up in Brookline, Massachusetts. My father died 25 years ago, before the age of the internet and the vast information that is now easily available. I don't think he necessarily knew the particulars of his mother's and grandmother's death, and for that I'm thankful. Like millions of other Jews, my early orientation to death was dominated by my attempt to understand the Holocaust and the lack of information about my mystery grandmother. It left me with a certain numbness concerning death. It was death on an incomprehensible level for a young boy to reconcile. It's incomprehensible at any age. In my family, tragic death seemed to lurk everywhere. In 1954, my father's first wife, Lillian, died unexpectedly at age 29 after just 6 short years of marriage, and he found himself the single parent of a 2-year-old daughter, my sister Gloria. Often I think of the devastation my father must have felt after all he had already endured. Perhaps he felt cursed, but he got on with his life. He remarried my mother, Sarita, a year later, and they were together for almost 30 years. Death was no less kind to my mother, Sarita. In 1940, her father died at age 54 when she was 17, simultaneously erasing any hope she had of going to college. At age 27, she married her first husband, Stanley. The next year, in 1951, she lost one of her newborns, my brother Walter's twin. 3 years later, just weeks after my sister Paula was born, Stanley died of a massive heart attack. A lot of death. Yet, much like my father, she transcended her tragedies in good stead. Neither of my parents seemed to have any great fear of death. I think their generation, the greatest generation of the Depression and World War II, just took death matter-of-factly. It was everywhere around them. As you can see, an almost unimaginable set of circumstances allows me to stand before you today. How do you reconcile your own birth with the tragic deaths of those that made your own life possible? In preparation for this talk, I've been doing extensive research on my family tree. Because of my unique situation, I find I'm as interested in my parents' first spouses as I am in my own true blood relatives. I think of Lillian and Stanley, whose early deaths allowed my parents to meet, as some sort of godparents that I never had the chance to meet. It's very gratifying to learn more about them and to honor their place in my life. My father, Max, died on New Year's Eve, 1984, after a long, debilitating series of medical problems. He was 62 and had just recently retired. And while I have missed him these past 25 years, it is just as Henry Nouwen tells us, death ends a life, not a relationship. I had a great relationship with my father, different than so many other men seem to have had. He loved and supported me unconditionally. We kissed on the lips and hugged our whole lives. I haven't lost him at all. He is very much with me and in me. I try to recall, not too well, and use some of his Yiddish expressions. When I make decisions or face dilemmas, his values come through me. Because of him, I never miss an election. My mother, Sarita, also died fairly young. After my dad died, she had over 10 years of good health and really enjoyed her golden years. With all the loss she had been through in her life, she never lost her joy of living and trying new things. In her 60s, she took courses in Russian, became very accomplished in Tai Chi, and founded a walking club in our hometown of Brookline, Massachusetts. Somehow, she too had healed back into life. Around age 70, a childhood episode of rheumatic fever and the resulting heart murmur finally began catching up with her. Always a very healthy, vigorous woman, over the course of 2 years, she was slowed markedly by her ailing heart. She used to walk for miles and miles effortlessly. Now she huffed and puffed up the stairs at home. So at age 72, she went in for voluntary valve replacement surgery. She felt that life without the replaced valve would be of very poor quality. I remember what she said the very night before the surgery when I visited her at the hospital. She said, "I'm not afraid to die. I don't want to die, but I'm not afraid." She never made it off the operating table. She hemorrhaged to death. I was left with those parting words the night before. Those words struck me then and stay with me to this day. They actually give me comfort. And just as with my father, my relationship with my mother has never really ended. Death came calling again 5 years ago this week. My wife Jean died of breast cancer on February 19th, 2007. Some of you here, like Linda, knew my wife Jean very well. She was one of the founders and central players in our women's group at Westminster Church. Her illness and our visibility in the church led to the birth of our caring circle. Her death has generated a tremendous amount of change and growth in my life, a life that itself had been full of change and growth over the 28 plus years we had been together. And I'm sure that her death changed many others as well. I recall the day in 2001 when Jean called to tell me that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. She had just spent many years taking courses one at a time to complete her master's and obtain her certification to teach middle school French. She had just begun her career after 14 years as a stay-at-home mom, teaching French part-time at Parkview Middle School in Cranston. I was crushed. She was devastated. I will spare you the details of her six-year struggle with this disease. For much of it, she was fine, or as fine as one can be under the circumstances. Towards the end, it was more than any person should have to bear, more than anyone should have to watch. But out of the fog of our family ordeal, out of Jean's death, springs life, as it must. Jean had an awful disease, an up and down journey of hope and despair, but in the end, she had a beautiful death. I sent out blog postings most every night, and I'm not a blogger. I sent out blog postings most every night during the last month of her life. The final half of 2006 had been just brutal. We went to Sloan Kettering in New York in January 2007, hoping for an 11th hour miracle, but it was not to be. The day after we returned, she ended up in the emergency room at Rhode Island Hospital and had a nightmarish stay there. When she was finally able to leave, we vowed we would never go back. Next time we had to call emergency. I told them we wanted her brought to South County Hospital. What a great decision that was. She was there for several weeks, starting an emergency, and then a brief respite in a regular patient room, and then her final destination, the ICU. South County, as you know, is a little gem with a family orientation, not the urban factory that Rhode Island Hospital had been. The staff doted on her. We all had free reign of the place. Jean's two sisters from the Midwest had come out and stayed with us for the last month or so, and they slept with her in the ICU room for 10 days. Best of all was Dr. Rubenstein, and I had the pleasure of meeting Jane this morning. Dr. Rubenstein, a nice Jewish boy, as my parents would have said, the hospitalist at South County. In a very brief period of time, this man was able to establish a relationship and gain our trust. And at a critical point in our decision making, he was able to change the tone of the conversation and ever so gently guide Jean to the point where she was able to make the decision to terminate treatment and return home under the care of hospice. From that moment, I had the rare privilege of observing death done right. The moment she made her decision, a tremendous burden was lifted off her shoulders. It was as if she had known for some time that this was what she wanted, but had gotten sidetracked by trying to stay strong and courageous for her family and friends. Dr. Rubenstein had given her permission to get off the treadmill she was on, and like Dorothy in Oz, it was almost hard to believe that going home could be so simple. Simply put, she was choosing to heal into her death. Our culture has a strong bias against those who don't pursue every possibility to cure their medical problems. There's often a subtle judgment made that such people are somehow weak. Anyone who knew Jean knew that that was not the case. She was stronger than I could ever hope to be, stronger than most of us could ever hope to be. No, she was the rare person who sensed the opportunity to control the manner of her death and grabbed it. The next 3 weeks would totally reshape my orientation and attitude towards death. There was nothing more powerful than to see her whole presence change the day we checked out of South County in early February. It was a beautiful day, very cold, but a brilliant blue sky, kind of like today, loving sunshine. Jean just radiated as we wheeled her to the car. She hadn't seen daylight in weeks and was simply basking in the glory of it all. And she was going home. Hospice is a misunderstood organization. Too often feared as the Grim Reaper, hospice is really an earthly gathering of angels doing holy work. How many of us will get to die at home, surrounded by our loved ones? How many of us will die pain-free? How many of us will have the chance to say their final goodbyes and have the opportunity to hear how much they have meant to people before they die? 2 weeks can't make up for 6 years, but let me tell you, they came damn close. Those 2 weeks were intensely spiritual for everyone involved. Those who were caring for her 24/7 at our house, those who were invited in for visits, and those of you on the outside who couldn't wait to read the next installment of my blog for another dose of inspiration. I described a glow that seemed to envelop our home. Time slowed down. There was a sense of peace that I have never experienced before. People coming to visit could sense it as soon as they walked in the door or into our den where Jean had taken up residence. It was a very healing space. Jean had slowly but surely eased herself into an almost Buddha-like state of serenity as her death approached. Experts in the field describe a period of transition for such people when connections to the world around them become weakened and replaced with an acceptance and even yearning for the peace of death. Excuse me. Mike, who is here today, and his brother Dan would read her the cards, letters, and tributes that people were sending in, and she loved them all, murmuring and cooing her approval. She was draped in her Westminster healing shawl and a quilt made for her by her best friend's support group. She was on an increasing dose of morphine, a wonder drug that allowed her to navigate through those last weeks virtually pain-free. She was truly able to heal into death. The night she died, we gathered in her room for a brief but poignant time of prayer, thanks, and reflection. A month later, over 400 people joined us at First Unitarian Church in Providence to celebrate her life on St. Patrick's Day. It was not a traditional service, but it was everything that Jean would have loved and hoped for. Healing into life and death, something we often hope for, and the truth is, it's available to us all. The title of this sermon was taken from a book that my friend Nancy Letts sent me in the month before Jean died, a book of the same title written by Stephen Levine, which I read from you earlier. While working with the terminally ill, Levine, director of the Hanuman Foundation's Dying Project, discovered an interesting phenomenon. In preparing for death, many were healed spiritually and emotionally. Further study led him to conclude that physical healing was also possible, often a byproduct of new balance of mind and heart. Vivid case histories of patients are used to illustrate how individuals learn to let go, become open to life, and stop struggling against illness, pain, and death. Part of my personal care during Jean's final illness and for some time after was to attend the open meditation hour in our sanctuary. Actually, I just went this last week. Or the Wednesday meditation group with Joanne Friday in our fellowship hall. Buddhists have this wonderful approach to death. It is inevitable, it is natural, and it shouldn't be stressed about. Many believe that we are here working out our karmas and that many lifetimes have been spent before and many more will follow as we learn our personal lessons. I'm open to this possibility. One of the great lessons is letting go. Letting go of material things, letting go of superficial people, and finally, letting go of our greed for life. I now view death not as a finality, a one-way ticket to a vast nothingness. I now view it as a natural part of my life's yet unfolding sequence of events. And I know I will live on in my children and those I have touched, just as Jean lives on for so many of us here today. How many of us carry around an orientation of death that no longer suits us? Some old tape from our childhood reminding us that death is some great specter hanging over us. A taboo subject that we all need to wrestle with in fear and gloom. How many of us blame ourselves for our illnesses or the illnesses of those we love? How many of us are shamed because we are not able to regain our health? Levine preaches that loving ourselves, accepting and coming to terms with our illnesses or impending death, even embracing them, can lead to a powerful healing. The blog I started in the months preceding Jean's death had two motivations. First and foremost, it was a mechanism for me to avoid the crushing weight of well-meaning phone calls to see how we were doing and what help we needed. Second, and less recognized by me at the time, was my need to have an outlet for what I was going through. Turns out that that need for an outlet created an opportunity for a very wide audience to experience Gene's final weeks and death up close. In hindsight, I marvel at how easily I was able to share my feelings. I thank my 20 years with the men's group for that. My writing poured out with no real thought of how emotionally intense it was or how it would be received. But soon enough, it became clear that a mass catharsis was playing out in the homes of our families and friends. For many people, it was the moment when they were able to confront their own deaths in a much more positive way. For others, it provided a blueprint for how they wanted to manage their own final days or that of a loved one. I'm glad we were able to do it for me, for them, and for Gene. I have observed a life healing into death, and from that, I have healed back into life. As our then minister, Barbara Fast, preached back in the fall of 2009, the only fitting response to our gift of life is gratitude, even if in that gratitude there is an acknowledgement of our eventual death. Garrison Keillor might have said it best, "Thank you, God, for this good life, and forgive us if we do not love it enough." I have been blessed to have had wonderful parents and loving siblings. I was blessed to have Gene as a wonderful partner to share life with for almost 3 decades. I am blessed to have 3 wonderful children, Matthew, Daniel, and Michael. Terry Mrozak was a blessing in my life for 4.5 years after Gene died. Today, I am blessed to have Marie in my life. I'm blessed with good health, a satisfying career, and financial security. I'm blessed to have my spiritual home at Westminster and a tremendous ongoing support and encouragement from so many people. My hope is that you will take these words and reflect on your own stories, your own litanies of death, and accept the invitation that is there for all of us to replace those old tapes with more calming, peaceful, and spiritually satisfying views. As you can see, I am still a work in progress. There is much death I have carried around for too many years. But I know I am emotionally healing a bit more with each passing month and year. There is opportunity for us all to heal emotionally. There's opportunity to heal back into life, and when the time comes, for us to heal into our deaths. I hope you can all support each other in your respective journeys. Thank you. Closing words from Mary Oliver. To live in this world, you must be able to do 3 things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. And when the time comes to let it go, to let it go.